Okay, hello everyone.
So this was a my assigned title, which I like a lot because it allowed me to actually focus on a fairly interesting topic. And in the past, I actually did quite some work on Blazor evolution and Blazor studies, but this is actually, believe it or not, my very first long talk on this topic because I always seem to like something else. But let me start with a LAT. Citing Meteocare is the biggest, sharpest, and fastest telescope ever launched in the gamma ray regime. And the interesting thing is that because of constant improvements, it becomes bigger. So the effective area actually grew recently, and also sharpest. One thing always worth remembering is that the PSF, the Poitzprint function, it has degree scale, a low energy, meaning 100 MeV, and becomes fairly good of the order of 0.1 degree. So just a few arc minutes above 10 GeV. So this gives you actually quite a different view of the high energy and low energy gamma ray sky. This is a plot of the cosmic background, and I typically use this to highlight the Fermi LAT. It's a quite unique machine. To my knowledge, it's the only telescope, satellite, that is able to measure constraints two cosmic backgrounds at the same time and to measure one cosmic background and resolve it almost entirely. COBE was an instrument, was a satellite that measured the CMB and the far infrared background, but it didn't resolve any of those. And ROSAT measured the X-ray background and partially resolved that, but none of them actually did the two things at the same time. And this just to tell you the capabilities of Fermi, which is able to measure large-scale diffuse emission over the entire sky and also achieve very good point source sensitivity. Fermi is first and foremost a Blazor machine, and I never said this to the LAT collaboration because they probably will kill me, but it is true, it has many other qualities, but 85 to 95% of all the sources that Fermi detects, if you correct for incompleteness of all the sources that might be Blazors and have not yet been identified, are very likely Blazors. So this means a tremendous amount of sources within the Fermi catalog. This is the steady increase of the Blazor, the associated Blazor, so the one we know they are Blazors as detected by the LAT, in the four Fermi catalogs that have been published so far. These are the full band catalog, so the one that do source detection above 100 MeV. This was the bright source list to the end here, the 3FGL catalog. The interesting thing is that flat spectrum radio quasars started being a larger population than BLX. When we turn on Fermi, they were of the same order after basically a year observation, and then BLX have constantly taken over the number of sources. We believe that Fermi has almost resolved the entire flat spectrum radio quasar population, with some exception, while the BLX population is actually growing a lot. If you are familiar with survey instruments and surveys in general, you know that you would expect a flattening of the number of detected sources with time just because of statistics and eventually systematic uncertainty. This is completely not happening right now with Fermi. Fermi keeps improving. Detection pipeline improves from catalog to catalog. And because of the release of new sensitive, more sensitive data sets, this actually keeps increasing. And the 4FGL, probably, which will be released in a year, will be somewhere up there. So really many, many sources. Eileen has already talked a bit about Blazors. In general, there is an entire family of them that goes from flat spectrum radio quasars, which are soft gamma ray sources, all the way to HBLs, which are the so-called high synchrotron peaked objects, which are hard gamma ray sources. So these are the hard Blazor population, basically, that we're dealing about here in this workshop. These are typical spectral energy distribution in the Fermi band of these kinds of objects. So this is a typical flat spectrum radio quasar spectrum, so it's pretty soft. It dies down. Change level. It dies down above a few GeV. The typical BLX, the average BLX, is flat, has a flat spectrum, so a power law with an index of E2 and a minus 2. The hard guys, which are the TV BLX, in Fermi are all seen as a power law, as a rising power law with an index of minus 1.8. So these are fairly hard sources. Now, Fermi is a bunch of selection effects. Because of the PSF, Fermi detects hard sources, because the photons are concentrated on a much smaller area, to much lower fluxes than soft sources. And this natural effect. Okay, so these guys are much more easily detected than these guys here. So BLX sources, hard BLX, are actually easy to detect with Fermi. And because of the good PSF, you are also easy to follow up initially. Eileen already showed the, what is called the Blaeser sequence, which is the fact that if you go to lower luminosity, you have a shift of the peaks to higher frequencies, okay? And this might imply a lack of strong cooling, basically, of the particle populations of the electrons. There have been many interpretations and many discussions about this. In general, the Blaeser problem in Fermi is a fairly well-determined problem in the sense that there are a lot of observables that can be used. There are redshifts and luminosities across the entire sample in different energy beams. There are photon indices that can be used to discriminate between objects. And then, of course, there are two other constraints, which are, one is a global constraint, which is the total extragalactic gamma ray background, and the other one is the fluctuations of the gamma ray background. Blaeser population does not need to account for both of them. In general, we don't force Blaeser population that we derive from this kind of observation to account for this. We leave this as a free variable. But in principle, you could try to look for a model that explains all these observations at once. But there are other sources other than Blaeser in the gamma ray sky. So all of this is done typically building a luminosity function, which it's basically the space density of objects as a function of their luminosity. And this is for galaxies. Typically, the most luminous guys are the rarest. And of course, the sky is full of very faint, low luminosity objects. Luminosity functions are fairly universal. They have this kind of shape. They have a ni, and the ni represents basically the luminosity of your average guy, in some sense. It's interesting to study the evolution of the luminosity function, because this tells you how and the mechanism of growth of these objects, or any object that you're studying, and also the powering, maybe. Typically, people are asking, you're looking at galaxies today, your objects today, and you're looking back in the past, you are asking whether sources were more luminous or more numerous in the past, or less, for example. The answer is that typically it is fairly complex. In the past, sources were either or both more numerous and more luminous. Okay. About some nomenclature. So this is one of the four the famous plots. This is the so-called Demandau plot. This is star formation rate across cosmic time from now, present epoch, back to the past. Actually, it's the opposite, from now back to the past. So people talk a lot about, and we already mentioned it, about positive and negative evolution. Positive evolution means that if you look back in time, you see a rise of the activity of the objects you are studying. And negative evolution will be the opposite, will be, you know, the objects are forming now or are more present now. Typically, positive evolution alone cannot exist. So what you expect is to see positive evolution, a redshift peak. So this is the peak of maximum formation or maximum activity, and then dies off. Because if you look at it from the Big Bang, these structures basically have to form. Okay, so this is the standard scenario. Negative evolution is by far less common and typically not very well seen, including by myself. Yesterday I looked at this. I at some point I realized that we must be talking about the same things, even though we show it in different ways. And yesterday I actually looked, maybe for the first time with the right eye, to the plot that Christoph showed. I mean, if you look here, okay, this is luminosity density, so this is not space density, so this is an evolution of something slightly different. This is low redshift, 0.5, and this is redshift 1, okay? So if you go here, the density or the luminosity density is increasing, okay? So this will be positive evolution. If you go here, this is negative evolution, okay? Here, okay, there is some positive evolution, but basically there is no evolution whatsoever between redshift 0.5 and redshift 1, so it's flat. Okay, so we're talking about something that is not strongly evolving in this region. Flat to borderline, if you're somewhere here, no evolving at all. So I went back and checked, because this is fairly normal. I went back and checked the Hopkins et al. 2007. It's so-called quasi-luminosity function, even though I think this is AGN luminosity function. If you look at it, this has been called many names, the anti-hierarchical behavior, cosmic downsizing, but it is the fact. So this is space density now. It is the fact if high luminosity objects, they show positive evolution, and of course they decline, fairly standard. But if you take the least luminous objects, okay, if you take within redshift 1.5, which is where basically we see these hard TVBLX, and maybe they might be helpful for the heating of the plasma, then what we see is that basically the evolution is flat. Assuming that these are the counterparts of the TVBLX, but this is fairly flat there. Now, when talking about blazers, we can assume, and it's fairly standard to assume that the parent population is anyway the AGN population of, for example, FR1 or FR2 radio galaxies. And the blazers are drawn from that. But there is one thing we should not forget. So rescaling luminosity function from another band is totally doable and has been done many times in the past. There is something we should not forget. I would not expect. And I remember I told Avery this whenever I saw this paper first. I would not expect right away that if you take a luminosity function from another band and you scale it down, that there is perfect agreement. The reason is that because of beaming, the objects that we're looking at are intrinsically less luminous. So this is beaming correction. This has been worked out by many, many people in the past. There is a fantastic paper by McGorry and Schaefer, 84. The luminosity that we measure is this guy here, which is basically the convolution of the beaming factor, which is the Doppler factor to the P, times an intrinsic luminosity, which is much lower. P reflects your beaming model, so it's an exponent that goes from 3 to 5 according if your jet is continuous, if it's blob, if your emission is dominated by synchrotron self-compton, or if it's external compton, so you can use whatever you want. Typically 4, it's what people use just, you know, to stay in the middle. Delta, the Doppler factor, depends on the distribution of your bulk Lorentz factor for your source population, which is, say, largely unconstrained. The only thing that we can say is that these beams are probably pointing everywhere in the sky, you know, randomly. So what happens is that if you take an intrinsic luminosity function that is flat, that is a simple power law, because of beaming, you basically distribute it over much larger luminosities. So basically, the slope of this luminosity function is reflected here, but then there is a very sharp, strong, fairly strong break, and actually another series of break. So this is the same case here, but divided by McGorry and collaborators into basically two populations with a limiting opening angle, which is the one that we will call blazers. Okay, so this will be the blazer counterparts of these guys, and this will be all the radio galaxies. Okay, so in general, I will not expect right away a simple scaling of the quasi-luminosity function down to work with TVs. I would expect that you would have to rescale down, but also to move to the right for the beaming correction. But if it works, it's fine. There might be some implications for the beaming. So for example, beaming might not be so important for TVBLX. All right. So problem with determining a reliable luminosity function of VLX is the fact that 50% of all BLX known lack a redshift measurement. Okay, so these are full spectrum radio quasar. We detect them all over the place. They are strongly evolving, as already said, and they peak around redshift 1. This is the observed redshift distribution. And these are the BLX. It tapers down. You can subdivide them according to the peak synchrotron peak position. And of course, the hard TV BLX are actually all a low low redshift here. Okay, but these are the ones for which we can actually measure a redshift, or people measure a redshift. There has been a lot of work in determining luminosity functions for BLX. We're not the first, probably not the last. The samples have always been very small and with roughly 50% completeness. Okay. The problem is here. This is a typical optical spectrum of a galaxy, and this is the BLX spectrum. Okay. So no lines whatsoever. What do you do with a spectrum that looks like this? Now, there are two reasons, we discussed them already yesterday, why the spectrum can be a power law. the galaxy spectrum or the continuum, the disk or the line region continuum spectrum can be swamped by the jet, simply much higher. So in this case, we have a beam completely aligned to our line of sight. These guys could also be flat spectrum radio quasar, just perfectly aligned, so we don't see any lines. Or the other case is that in some objects, there could be just a weak or completely absent disk broad line region radiation. Okay, this has been around for a long time, and we believe that actually these are the counterparts. I mean, this is what happens in most of the TVBLX. So what do you do? Well, we don't give up. We try everything to measure all constraints redshifts of BLX. And we, with some success, mostly due to Roger Romani, who had a campaign lasting for over 10 years to constrain redshifts of BLX. And this includes several methods. And I'm going in order, like, of, let's say, reliability of them. So the best thing you can do, if there are no optical emission lines, is you use high-resolution spectrometer and you look for absorption lines due to intervening gas basically along the way. These could be galaxies along the way. The typical absorption lines that's used is magnesium 2. Okay? If you see it and you're confident that's it, you get a spectroscopic lower limit, which is very good. This guy is a redshift larger than 1.5. The second one, this is what I contributed and we contributed, photometric redshift. So if your BLX is a redshift large enough, then you will start seeing the dropout in the UV optical part of the spectrum due to the absorption due to hydrogen along the line of sight. We use several bands, and the most sensitive part is, of course, the UV optical. There are not many UV telescopes out there. We use the UVOT on board of SWIFT. This led us actually to the detection of this guy, PKES0630, which in Fermi is seen as an extremely hard power law, an index of 1.8 and a strong cutoff around 100 GeV. Okay? So to give you an idea, this is a spectrum done already maybe 3 or 4 years ago. This object is as hard as Markarian 421, but it's a redshift 1.6. Okay? This object here is what triggers us and set us on measuring the excitatory background light, the absorption due to the excitatory background light with the LAT, using all the other objects for which we actually had redshift. And this is actually what we found. This is the attenuation e to the minus tau as a function of redshift and energy. And this is the attenuation you see in the LAT. In the spectra, basically stacked spectra of 50 BLX in each band, you clearly see that the EBL attenuation is really well detected above redshift of 0.5 for BLX. There is no tension with, like, say, modern models that explains or predict the EBL attenuation based on galaxy counts. But all the previous models, like Stecker et al. Model, that have larger UV or optical component, are ruled out just because you would expect more absorption than we actually see. Okay? So this was just a quick intermezzo. So in reality, one of the nice discoveries of Fermi, totally confirmed, contemporary to the one of also Cherenkov collaboration, is that high redshift BLX exists. And hard spectrum high redshift BLX exists, which is awesome, because we can do a lot of cosmology with them, study the excitatory background light and maybe plasma beam instabilities. This is the spectrum now combined SED of the object I showed you before. It's really remarkable. And it really, the cutoff we see is really consistent with the one due to the EBL. So, I told you about photometric redshift. Now, 90% of all the objects that we target with this program, we target already 200, they show a simple power law. This means we can set a photometric upper limit on the redshift, which is less than 0.1, 1.2. Okay? This is not too bad, because this gets coupled, because we can do this really quick. This is a few minutes in integration. We can couple this to all the spectroscopic upper limits, all the spectroscopic lower limits, to get a fairly good measurement of the redshift. Third method by Roger Romani and his ex-PhD student Michael Shaw, based on another old idea, I think, launched by Meg Urie and collaborators, is that ELX are hosted by giant elliptical galaxies which behave as standard candles, and they have a luminosity, an absolute luminosity, very well centered around minus 0.22 and a half. Okay. Now, there has been a lot of work that's been tested by Sbarufati and also by Michael Shaw in his paper, and indeed they look like this works. I mean, of course, there is a distribution, but we know that they are all hosted by elliptical galaxies. So what do? You target with sensitive imaging all the sources. If you see the host, it's good, then you know the redshift. If you don't see it, you can set a lower limit, and you can do the same thing spectroscopically. So you will see emission lines from the galaxy. Okay. So this is the result. So this comes from Mike Shaw's paper. So this is the original distribution. So these are the source classes with a major redshift from the literature. Okay. So this will be our hard sources. Okay. Now, these are the redshift at which they are all the objects for which they could measure a redshift constraint. So if you see it, all the objects without a redshift measurement, an easy spectroscopic redshift measurement, are found to lie a slightly higher redshift than the average. Okay. So if you take, you know, the BLX with a redshift measurement, and then you target all the other 50% without a redshift, then you will see that their average is slightly higher redshift. Okay. And there is a nice population of sources above redshift 1. Okay. Now, the green guys are the class of BLX, which are the most similar to the flat spectrum radio quasar. So these are the guys that can show sometimes lines. So it's not surprising that they can extend all the way to redshift 2. But it's very interesting when you see hard BLX that extends above redshift 1. So this is reported in the third LAC, in the TRILAC catalog, basically the third catalog of active galactic nuclei. So these are the objects, hard BLX with a redshift. And these are limits, lower limits and upper limits, for all the objects of the same class that we could figure out. I mean, if you make the average is somewhere here. So there is an indication these guys are at higher redshift. So when working out the luminosity function, we combine all these redshift constraints. Some of them are loose. Some others are much better. So this is the case where we couple a fairly sensitive spectroscopic lower limit to a photometric upper limit. So the redshift of this guy is basically constrained within redshift 1.4 and 1.55. The 4 BLX, I mean, it's pretty awesome. So we used a sample of 200 BLX, for which we had, I think, 95% redshift completeness, including those constraints. So it's fairly large. And this is the evolution as we found it. It's compared to flat spectrum radio quasars, so to show what is different, okay? So flat spectrum radio quasar, they show the typical quasar behavior, okay? So they have a redshift peak, so strong positive evolution at all luminosities and a redshift peak. And the redshift peak moves to higher redshift with larger luminosities. Very standard. Now, for comparison, if you take BLX, there is a redshift peak, so there is positive evolution for the largest luminosity. Although, if you squint your eyes, I mean, you can imagine that this could be also flat or flattish. Do we see an evolution of the redshift peak? Well, if there is, I mean, it's really small. They could all be at the same redshift. And something fun is happening at the lowest luminosity. I mean, there is no redshift peak whatsoever. So actually, I stole this slide from Yoshinoe. It says HBLs show negative evolution, like unlike any other AGN, which is true. This will be the luminosity function at redshift zero. I mean, if you could observe in the local universe all the blazars, well, and if basically this will be the space density of flat spectrum radio quasar, and this will be the space density of BLX, which is much larger at low luminosities. So in the local universe, a lot of sources could be BLX. Okay. Now, this is the space density. I masked this, but I want to show you first the high redshift behavior. Okay. So these are flat spectrum radio quasars, and these are BLX. Okay. Their space density evolution is the same. They're increasing. Okay. Now, What happens at low redshift is that, of course, the quasar activity tapers off and dies. I mean, there are no strong quasars in the local universe. There are no strong flux spectrum antiquasars in the local universe. While the one of BLX picks up almost exactly where these guys die. So this redshift 0.5 that Jim was referring to yesterday. So, and they reach this density here that we measure basically in the local universe. Mostly, this seems to be accounted for by these hard spectrum BLX, these HSPs, okay? So this is negative evolution, okay? Something that keeps growing from earlier epochs all the way basically to us. So these objects are still forming. Why? I mean, there is an attractive theory, the one of Cavalier and Delia and contemporary by Becher and Dermer, 2002, the so-called genetic link. You need a strong event to trigger a quasar and a strong flux spectrum radioquasar event. This event doesn't last long, hundreds of million years here. Eventually, you are left with a fairly inert elliptical galaxy with no gas, but you have a black hole here that probably is a radiatively efficient accretion flow and switches here to a radiatively inefficient mode for a much longer time. So this could last billions of years. Now, following the discussion yesterday, which was very good, I wish that we had this before, a few years ago, I actually went back and check the paper of Merloni et al., 2008, which is this Andrea Merloni and Sebastian Haines. This is a very good paper for black hole growth in the universe. So there are a couple of things. So this is the supermassive black hole mass function, okay? Basically, the density of the supermassive black hole. If you take 10 to the 9, which is the typical supermassive black hole for hard TV blazers, then you can see that from redshift 0.1 to redshift 1.6 or 1.5, you know, there is very little evolution. So the number density of this object doesn't change. So the engine is still there from redshift 1.5 to redshift 0.1. This is the accretion rate density as a function of cosmic time or redshift. It follows typical quasar activity and star formation activity with a peak around redshift 2. But they isolate. And I failed to notice this before. They isolate all the inefficient modes, the inefficient radiation, the radiatively inefficient modes. They call also radio modes, so standing for jet launching mode. And you can see that this grows all the way basically to here. This follows really well basically what we see for BLX. So the inefficient accretors seems to negatively evolve. Okay. Now for the heating of the intergalactic medium, what matters is the luminosity density. So basically, how many photons above a given energy, which I assume probably is some TV energy, you emit in redshift. And you can see that basically this is this will be above 100 MeV. One will have to convert this or compute this above, I don't know, TV. But basically, this follows the standard quasar behavior. So this is not much of a problem as long as the throughput in the intergalactic medium is large. Okay, so I don't see much of a problem there. But I don't think there is, I don't know, I find very compelling that there is some negative evolution at low redshift.
So when you do this, to which kind of luminosity did you integrate your luminosity function? Is it just all observed or you have, you know, because then that could just continue to, like if you look at your plot, early plot, you're showing the luminosity function.
Yeah, typically all these plots are integrated to whatever is observed. So no extrapolations. I mean, the extrapolations are high luminosity, typically it doesn't matter because it's such a steep power law. It does not contribute. So it's the low end, yeah, which minimal luminosity, we stop at the lowest observed luminosity, which is of the order, I think, of, if I remember correctly, 10 to the 44 ergs per second. I mean, there could be a lot more objects below that. Okay, finally, about the Blaser sequence, even though this is less important here, this comes from the luminosity function. This is the distribution of the photon index as measured by Fermi as a function of luminosity class, and we see some evolution. Okay, so these are the low luminosity guys, the high luminosity guys. The low luminosity guys are harder than the high luminosity BLX. So these are indication of maybe the Blaeser sequence. But this also means, I mean, it goes in favor of anything that we want to do with BLX. If you go to low luminosity, most sources will be hard, which is good. It's good for the EBL, it's good for the heating of the intergalactic medium. Finally, a couple of nice things. We did the exercise that Urey and Schaefer theorized in 84, and we applied it to the Fermi data. So we tried to derive what looks like an intrinsic luminosity function, but we were interested in some of the jet parameters. Okay, so we assume that in the rest frame, the luminosity function of these blobs is a power law. So this means probably, you know, there are less more luminous guys than high than low luminosity guys. And basically, we derive some interesting jet parameters. A couple of them are basically the opening angle or the angle to the line of sight. Okay, these are a theoretical exercise from BLX and flat spectrum radio quasar. There is no correspondence of one-to-one. This is correct under the assumption in a statistical sense. Flat spectrum radio quasar seems to be a lot more beamed than BLX, in particular hard BLX. But hard BLX can have very large gamma factors, a few of them. Okay. Some of these things can be checked thanks to Mojave data that measure the Doppler factor and the opening to the atom side, the opening or the angle to the atom side directly. And for those data, I think these pictures is fairly well confirmed, but still an exercise. Okay, moving on to the extratic gamma ray background. This is the extratic gamma ray background measured by Fermi using 6 years of data all the way up to 800 GeVs. And this is the integrated emission of blazers. Okay. So as Christoph showed yesterday, basically hard blazers, which are here, sitting here, they account for most of the extratic gamma ray background above 10 GeV. But there is a clear excess below 10 GeV where we believe the blazers are not responsible for the entire background. Indeed, if you sum up all the other source classes, so star forming galaxies and radio galaxies, which are out there, you get a very nice reproduction of basically the entire extratic gamma ray background. Okay, and this can be used to set limits, for example, on the dark matter cross section or other things. So this is about the extratic gamma ray background. What about the fluctuations? So Fermi measured the fluctuations of the gamma ray background. So this is a spectrum of the angular power in different bins. So these are the black measurements. This is reported in a paper of Di Mauro et al. So there are fluctuations in the gamma ray sky, and these are attributed to a population of point sources, which is not clustered, which is all right. The spectrum is consistent with the one of blazers. It typically shows a 2.4, e to the minus 2.4 behavior. And in this plot, which shows basically the index below the break of a source counts distribution and the break position, basically what we derived a few years ago is that the picture is such that blazers account for roughly 100% of the angular power, so they are responsible for the fluctuations that we see, but they are not responsible for 100% of the gamma ray background. They're only responsible for roughly 50%. Now, there are some predictions here that are reported by Mattia Di Mauro. I think one is my model, another one is his model, and I hope these are reported correctly, but these are the prediction for the angular power from the luminosity function derived by Avery and collaborators. And this is a little bit higher. So there was some discussion in the past that maybe this was wrong. Now it's of a few days ago that actually we can show this. So this is the new measurements of the angular power, not finalized, measured by Fermi using PASS8. You can see it goes up a little bit from what where it used to be, but not that much. Okay, and it's here it's in very good agreement with what he had before. So this is not out, so you should still wait for that. But the angular power seems still consistent as due to blazers. So people have done some interesting exercises, and this goes along to some of the things Christoph described yesterday. This is an exercise by Yoshino and collaborator. He assumed that there is one source population. This has been done by many other people in many different ways. He assumed that there is one source population with a fairly hard spectrum, call them hard VLUX, contributing here around 10 GB. He basically says he used the previous data set of Fermi to normalize their emission here, and he said, you know, whatever is their emission, it should not violate these data points here that he leaves up there. Now, if you have a spectrum which is really rising, the cascade component is huge, which is this blue component. So what he did in this case, he played with models of the evolution, and he said, okay, what kind of evolution has the source population? He didn't give it a name there. Source population in order not to exceed these data points, the orange data points there. And he found, according, I mean, there is a strong prior, which is this spectrum here, that if you have a strong positive evolution, you basically overproduce this data. So you need to have at least a flat over non-evolving population. Okay, this was done 2012, so fairly before we actually published our result. So there is a problem. If you have a strongly evolving population, then the cascade component is large. So you have a lot of reprocessed flux. A lot of flux is absorbed by DBL, and you have a very strong cascade, which typically might create some problems. Okay, some new results. Last year, almost on the day, the Fermi celebrated its 7th birthday, which was sometimes in June. Fermi got as a present a completely facelift of his event reconstruction analysis. What this gave is a much better sensitivity, so it increased the acceptance by a factor of 20% across all energies and much more at high energy, and also pushed the boundary, basically, of what we can detect up to a few TeVs, so a couple of TeVs. The point spread function also improved, basically, everywhere. The improvement is also dramatic at low energy, but I won't discuss low energy right now. So what we did is actually we set up on a new adventure. We released a new catalog of sources detected above 50 GV. Why 50 GV? Is because it's a new window. We wanted to be in a window as close as possible to the one sampled by Cherenkov telescope from the ground, and then we also wanted to understand better some of the properties of this hard VLUX. Okay, so this is a map Jim showed already yesterday. This is the sky above 50 GV. It's almost background free. It's very few photons, but almost no background whatsoever, so you actually need only very few photons to detect a source. This means it's not very good for variability studies, but point source detection, it's fantastic. One of the very first things we can do is actually assemble spectral energy distribution in the LAT integrated over n years, say 6 years, across 4 decades in energy. Okay, so these are all these hard VLUX. What we see here is that their peak in the spectral energy distribution is around 100 GVs. Okay. Now, we could have done exactly the same using TV data, and we knew that already, but it's nice to see that again here. Now, this is fairly important because whenever we compute a cascade component or a contribution of sources to the gamma ray background or the fluctuations, well, this is one of the most critical parameters. Basically, how many high energy photons are you converting with ABL? We all use this kind of parametrization for the HBL spectrum, which is a typical double power law with an index. A low index of typically 1.8, a high energy index which can be of the order of 3, but this now has to be of the order of 100 GeVs, so not really 1 TeV. 1 TeV will be an exceptional blazer, which is, I would say, is not the average Fermi blazer. Okay, it's more the average maybe TeV blazer, but not the average Fermi hard VLUX. Now, if Fermi is a blazer machine, the 2FHL catalog is a fantastic generator of HSP blazers. So this is the synchrotron peak frequency of blazers selected in the main Fermi catalogs. So you can see there are a lot of flux spectrum radio quasar and hard VLUX here. Above 50 GV, 90% of the objects that you detect are hard VLUX. So this is the band where you want to be if you want to study those objects. We see a lot of interesting things. We see effects of EBL. We see that the spectra of all these objects, they soften dramatically as you go high in redshift. So from roughly an average of 3 to an average of 5. We lack statistic, of course, at the highest redshift. This is the typical gamma ray horizon plot. the Fazio-Stecker plot separates the transparent universe from the opaque universe, we do see photons that cross basically an optical depth of 3, but we don't have strong problem or strong tension with the EBL, so there is no problem there. It looks like a very natural EBL attenuation, and we realized this basically by looking at the break between the 2FHL measured index and the 3FGL. Basically, this is the break of the high energy part of the SED with respect to the one measured by at 100 MeV. So there is a softening, and this softening is compatible with the one you expect just by EBL for a standard simple synchrotron self-Compton model. I'll skip this. I'll go on to something nice. So above 50 GeV, I think we all agree, all model predictions show that blazars might account for the entire background, the entire gamma ray background, okay, above this energy. So we put this hypothesis into test with Mattia Di Mauro on a paper that was accepted just last week. So we derived a source count distribution, okay, of these blazars. Relying on Monte Carlo simulations of the entire sky, we found that to within the fluxes sampled by the LAT, this source count distribution is Euclidean, okay? So it shows an index of this distribution that scales with the flux to minus 1.5. So, right, you can do very much with it because you cannot integrate it because this diverges. So what we did, we looked at the fluctuations of the gamma ray sky in a simple way. This is not the full power spectrum analysis, but this is the so-called fluctuations analysis. So you bin basically the sky in pixels, and then you count how many pixels with how many counts are there in the sky. Of course, the pixels with many counts are the ones where, you know, there are bright sources, and there are very few because there are not so many sources in the sky. There are lots of pixels which have just one photon or zero photons. So this analysis is very interesting because it allows the sensitivity of the LAT is such that you detect at the limit, you detect a source with three photons. Okay, so this is the flux limit corresponding to here. This kind of analysis pushes the limit to the regime where your source population for a pixel in the sky gives you just 0.5 photons, okay, which is the limit here, 10 to minus 12. So via simulations, we basically try to match the observed distribution of counts to the one basically implied by a given source count distribution. And these are the 1 sigma and 3 sigma contours, so basically on how the source count distribution should behave below the threshold. These are all the models that we know of in the literature. So there is the model of Paolo Giommi, the model of Mattia Di Mauro, my own model, and the model of Avery. I think this misspelled, this should be 2012. And they're all doing well, reasonably well. We are all overshooting a little bit up there, but it's not by much. So in general, I think all the models, they reproduce this fairly well. So this, which tells me, we are all describing the evolution, the underlying evolution of RTVBLX in the same way. Of course, it's never nice when a break happens right at the threshold. Remark also that the referee gave us. So we improved our analysis by a bit. We looked at under threshold sources, which are never reported, and we actually can confirm a break there, basically, at that energy. There are also other reasons why there should be a break. I could discuss them later. This is another representation of the log and log s of the source count distribution. And these are lines where basically your source population makes 85% of the background. So basically, you can see that the implied source count distribution of RBLX basically makes 85% of the gamma ray background. So basically, nearly all the gamma ray background we measured is done by BLX. And this is interesting. This is one of my last lines. I still have two to go. For example, for another thing, which is the neutrino flux. Now, we can assume that in the 2FHL range, which is here, the entire gamma ray background is due by BLX. So this means it's not due to something else. And one of the main things is not due to starburst galaxies, which are detected by Cherenkov telescope and Fermi. Starburst galaxies, their emission is powered basically by proton-proton collisions, so hadronic collisions. So you can make a fairly simple model and say, what is the neutrino flux due to starburst galaxies and what is the reprocessed component in the Fermi band. And it turns out that you don't want to overproduce more than 15% of this gamma ray background. And this means that your neutrino flux from starburst, so from hadronic interaction in starburst galaxies have to be really low. So this means very likely starburst galaxies are not accounting for the entire flux as detected by IceCube. One of the last questions, this is quick. The cascade component might exist, might not exist, but there is a thorough study done by Justin Fink and collaborators this year that shows even if it existed within the parameters scanned by his Monte Carlo simulations, the reprocessed components due to the hardest blazars which are in the Fermi samples with TV emission, it's low, so it's less than 10%. This is why we never ever reported it when we make assumption, when we try to reproduce the gamma ray background, because it's uncertain, first of all, it might not exist a second, and anyway, it's low. So this is 10% for the hardest sources. For all the softest sources, it's going to be less. Finally, it's really hard to keep up with a survey instrument that works really well. This is the first catalog above 10 GeV in 3 years of data. You can see, I mean, this was already incredibly nice when we issued it a few years ago. And this is something that will be issued maybe this summer. This is the second catalog above 10 GeV using 8 years of data, NPAS-8. You can see how nicely resolved is the galactic plane, the bubbles, and there is an excess of over 1,700 point sources compared to 500 where we came from. So it's a lot of work. These are my conclusions. So blazars produce roughly 50% of the gamma ray background and likely account for 100% of the anisotropies that the LAT measured. Within uncertainties, which are many because there are many parameters, particularly what is the maximum energy and the peak energy of the TV spectrum we are using, the B field strength, the coherence length, the cascade component is not very important in the LAT band. If plasma instabilities are there, might not exist at all. And we certainly haven't detected it yet. Bielak evolution, I hope I convinced you, Bielak evolution is low, if not negative. Negative evolution is interesting, unexpected. Now, there is an argument, for the fact that the blazars in general should follow the quasi-luminosity function. There is a counter-argument why this should be negative. Bielaks may be drawn from the parent population of FR1s. FR1s sit in the center of galaxy clusters. Galaxy clusters are the only population with a certified negative evolutions because they're still forming, okay? I agree that if there is a population with a strong positive evolution that emits lots of hard photons, so photons of TV energies, and if there is a cascade, then the cascade will be strong, and so there might be some tension. High redshift Bielaks of the hard kind exist, which is great. It's great for all the reasons. And finally, we should not forget there are tons of selection effects when we talk about blazars. One of them is the beaming. Negative evolution, if you want my straight opinion, negative evolution might be fooled if you assume that there is an evolution of the opening angle. So if you assume that all the sources are low redshift, have a fairly wide beam, and the beam is decreasing, if you go in redshift, then of course, I mean, this will be a selection effect that will lead you to detect more sources at low redshift than the representative parent population. That's it. Thank you.
Time for a few questions. Why can't you rule out intrinsic absorption by peer production for making this cutoff in your?
In the Bielaks, first of all, we don't think there are strong components. And
there should be a question case. You said the average angle is towards really good.
It is not supposed to evolve exactly as the EBL cutoff evolves. So we find a very good agreement with what the EBL evolves.
Oh, I think this is a very important point.
We have a sample of redshift zero Bielaks, for which we see it, which is our control sample, for which we see no effect whatsoever. So this is our control sample, and we don't see any absorption. And later work, which I skipped on, shows that there is no evolution in the spectral property of this hard Bielaks within the range and uncertainty that we can probe, so from redshift 0 to redshift 2.
Okay.
So they're pretty well behaved, considering these are the worst objects ever.
If it's intrinsic absorption, you should also get just a different Z. You should get the energy that also pushes level, right? It depends on the redshift.
You will get it redshifted, no?
Yeah. And that can be ruled out. We don't see that.
Yeah, no, we don't see that.
Very nice talk.
Thanks.
Lots of exciting things that I'm sure I'll be talking to you about over the next day and a half. But the just to pick one near the end, you said roughly 10% of the background could come from the cascades. Or Justin said 10%.
This applies only to these five guys, which are extreme. I mean, these are the ones for which we had the largest expectation to see cascades. So these are hard, very hard VLACs. Mm-hmm. And there is a limit of at most 10%.
So that must be intimately tied to where that break is.
Yeah, it depends a lot on the energy.
If you push the break down to 100 GeV, then you really go from flat to gamma 3 above that.
Mm-hmm.
Then 10% is the number you get, right? Unless I'm missing because you'll reprocess, at least with a high redshift sources, you'll reprocess almost the entirety of the energy above the TeV down to 1 to 100 GeV.
It's correct, but I didn't make a point here that these are not the average. These are five sources chosen because they are very hard at TV energies, and we have Fermi data. Okay, so these are the guys that probably don't have a break at 100 GeVs. They have in the TV band. So these are the best ones.
So then I guess I'm confused because I just by doing a simple accounting of saying I have this much luminosity from 1 TeV on up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to reprocess all of that, and maybe that's the step that I'm not allowed. But I'm going to reprocess all of that, and I'm going to dump it into 1 TeV maps to about 1 GeV,
sure.
1 GeV to say 100. Then I would get a comparable number of photons or gamma rays as you get from a flat spectrum below it.
Mm-hmm.
So that would suggest 100% contribution, right? I mean, if everyone were like that.
Oh, sorry, yeah. I think, so this 10% refers to the emission that we measure in the Lat band, okay? So we see a spectrum in the Lat band above, say, 1 GeV. We don't know whether this is primary or secondary. 10%, we believe that cascade, the reprocessed components, is 10% than that. What you said holds probably true for what is the fraction that is reprocessed. But you know, if you consider what is the fraction of secondary, so the cascade component, to the primary, in the Lat band, is probably less than 10%.
That does, I mean, for these guys, that doesn't make sense, right? Because
yeah.
The GeV, the initial emission, yeah, not reprocessed, is much lower in the GeV band than the TV band by definition.
Yeah.
The reprocessed stuff, as I've already said, has to have the same flux as the stuff you've lost.
Sure.
It has to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be 10%.
Yeah, it's going to be, if it were completely flat, it would be 100%, right? And if you're flat up to the break, then and the break's at a TV, then maybe 50% because you've got a break. So that's what I'm, but if you move the break down to 100 GeV, then that's your factor of 10, right? So I guess
the break is not moved. I mean, this is using Fermi data and TV data, so this depends on the actual spectrum measured by these telescopes. So
I guess we need to go look at Justin.
Yeah,
and that 10% is the prediction based on these.
Basically, this component over the whatever is the primary one. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a question about, you showed a figure about the spectrum or the break energy seen in Fermi. Can you maybe go back to that?
What was that?
So you made a statement that the break energy of HPLs is about 100 GeV.
Yeah.
But this is the observed spectrum, not the intrinsic spectrum, right?
This is the observed spectrum, correct.
So that basically means after para-absorption.
Yeah.
So if you deabsorb the spectra and then we now it becomes uncertainty, so what is the true distribution of ray energies? But if this is much higher, then of course the cascading point is higher.
Of course. But I mean, if you take this object, for example, DBL within redshift 0.03, and this energy is not so large that, I mean, it will make it up.
No, it
may going up.
Really that one, but
yeah, I mean, but it's a good point. I mean, it's large.
No, but can the EBL produce a cutoff at 100 GeV? I doubt it. That's what it's
no, this is not. Higher. This is not EBL cutoff for those.
What does it? What does cause? What
it's electron cooling. Electron cooling, no.
What mechanism? From you said from gamma 1 of 1.8 to 3?
These are presumably an inverse constant of the synchrotron peak. Okay, so that's going to be peak. It's not a power one, right? It's going to turn over. And I thought that it ran a GV.
What's the theoretical basis for that? I thought you do it by absorption.
Synchrotron self-Compton.
You have a peaked input synchrotron spectrum. And the same electrons, or maybe another population of electrons, is upscattering that. So now you have a peak spectrum up here, right? It just happens that you're in the rising portion of the peak for the high synchrotron peak sources in Fermi. So it looks like a rising power ball, right? But it has to come down for the same reason too.
It's just time integrated, but it's effluent. It's not the spectrum. This is you said it's integrated over many years.
Yeah. This is an average flux.
Well, you have to take the flux and integrate it over many years.
I don't understand the distinction in this context.
But you have an evolving particle distribution function.
Oh, but they're constantly being injected at the bottom of the engine.
By what?
By the engine. So in this case, the AGM.
Yeah. It's flaring object. You cannot constantly inject. Just
So the point, coming back here to where the peak is, which is important for anything predicting, you know, the gamma ray background. So there is a distribution of peak positions, okay? But if I had to choose a center, I would center it more at 100 GeV rather than 1 TeV, okay? That, of course, I mean, you should consider the entire spectrum of all these objects.
Why 100 GeV? What's so special about 100 GeV? Why is it not 1 TeV or 10 GeV?
So I think it must be a distribution, right? And then when we talk about TeV blazars, necessarily you must be talking about things that people want have higher energies, otherwise you have lower TeV fluxes and they won't be there.
Did you do that experiment, just log parabolic fits to the deabsorbed spectra of all Fermi blazars?
I did it in the past when we had to work out the contribution of blazars to the gamma ray background. The log parabolic models work well only on a narrow energy range at the peak. If you have a large energy range, then typically what you see, which is also the model used by Avery and collaborators, is that the rise here, this branch, the intrinsic one, falls quicker than the rise here. So this is typically 1.8 and this is typically 3, for example, which I agree. So the log parabolic model will not capture this well. It's a little asymmetric.
Even after the absorption.
Yeah. I mean, we know that the log parabolic, I mean, in the synchrotron part, the log parabolic model doesn't work unless, you know, you are around the peak.
Could I
ask about beam corrections?
Mm-hmm.
So I was scratching out what kind of correction I would expect. Of course, it depends upon, like you said, how wide a variation in angles you have, which in practice depends upon maybe jet power, right? What range of gamma jet runs back to.
Sure.
But I thought that the range of intrinsic angles, radio angles, which is related to both of these, for these things, relatively narrow for the VLAX. Especially narrow for the hard VLAX.
So then the best resource are the Mojave paper. And if you look, and they report VLAX and.
Is this one with push, read by Pushcraft? Or is. There's a whole slew of them, but I know the
I think,
that
so there's, I quoted somewhere, I think one of the latest is Savolainen, I mean, whenever I did that, it was Savolainen et al. They're in the talk, which I leave. These are difficult measurements, so there are, but there is a nice sample, maybe 50 objects, and these are Fermi blazars. And there are also other blazars, not Fermi detected. And I think they see the same thing, okay? They see that plus Petronio quasars are more beamed. You do expect a little bit that by external Compton than BLX.
But I thought they were all much more narrow than your average radio blazar. Mm. So the number that sticks in my that I recall is that the median for the Fermi blazars was BLX 1.6 degrees. It's the full width, half max of the radio jet on parsec scale.
It could be. I mean, I will trust it. I mean, this is an exercise. It's a little narrow for a BLX, I think.
It is. That was the point. The gamma ray VLX were narrow.
Yeah, it's a little narrow.
And then the range about that was maybe a factor of two.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It could be. I mean, I'd be happy to read about it. So I remember a little bit the opposite. I remember flat spectrum radio quasar at an opening angle of roughly 1 degree, which is what we kind of find. But I mean, radio measurements of this should be trusted more. That's an exercise, you know, using some machinery there.
Well, the relationship between the radio jet and the gamma ray jet.
Yeah.
That's one point.
So, there are no more questions. Let's thank Marco once again.